This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the recent development of Julian Assange pleading guilty to one charge of espionage.
It was the mass movement around the world that got Julian Assange out of prison. We saved his life, and no one did a less important role than Randy Credico, to whom we speak today.
We also speak with noted human rights attorney Reed Brody about the International Criminal Court.
The prosecutor of the court has indicted Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the Minister of Defense of Israel, for crimes against humanity and war crimes. This could be a turning point in international law.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. After serving 1,901 days in solitary confinement in a tiny cell in London's infamous Belmarsh prison, journalist and publisher Julian Assange is free at last. Julian gained his freedom pursuant to a plea bargain with the government of the United States, which had sought to extradite him and try him under the 1917 Espionage Act. He faced a certain conviction in a hostile Virginia court and 175 years in prison on 17 counts of conspiracy to commit espionage for receiving and publishing information damaging to the U.S. government. Julian Assange was forced to plead guilty to one count of espionage in return for the time he served in prison. Prior to that, he was confined for 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had sought and received political asylum. The alleged crime he was accused of committing was the receipt and publication in 2010 of the so-called Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, which document American government guilt in torture and murder, including the 11 civilians and 2 Reuters journalists. Julian Assange was sentenced to time served by an American federal court judge on an island in the Pacific Ocean 2,000 miles from Australia. Julian will now be living as a free man in Australia with his wife and 2 children. We speak today with Randy Credico, a steadfast supporter of Julian Assange. Mr. Credico hosted the program Countdown to Freedom in support of Julian for many years, and he visited him 3 times in Belmarsh Prison. Randy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure. I think this is the first time I've been on Law and Disorder in the 20 years I've been listening to it.
Oh, that can't be.
Well, my memory's shot.
Well, congratulations after all the work you've done on behalf of freeing Julian Assange. He's been called the greatest journalist of our generation. Why is that? And what did he do to embarrass the American government?
As far as the greatest journalist of our generation, I don't know where you start our generation, but you know, certainly one of the greatest journalists, one of the maybe the boldest journalists and the most innovative journalists of our generation. What did he do? Well, first of all, he exposed war crimes. He exposed torture with his war logs. But more significantly, the reason why he was undergoing this, you know, the last 5 years of torture, being renditioned into that hellhole, Belmarsh, is because he infuriated in 2017 the CIA with the release of Vault 7. I've always said that was the underlying reason why they were going after him. It's been an inexorable, you know, persecution from the CIA directing this ever since. I think Vault 7 is very significant because it shows you how widespread and how deep the CIA apparatus and operations are on spying on people around the world and mostly Americans. So I think that's it. I think that's the boldest thing that he's done. I think that's the reason why this thing has dragged on for so long. And plus, he poses a danger, and his way of operating poses a danger to those who are involved in into lying, into corruption, and into wars, and all of these things that are bad. If they really wanted to shut up Julian Assange from the outset, all they would have to do is change, you know, the way they operate, you know, not have that coup in Ukraine in 2014, for instance. You know, there are a lot of things going on right now, and I'm sure they're very happy that the press is not really digging, the mainstream media is not really digging in to the government's activities behind the scenes.
With respect to Vault 7, I understand that Vault 7 allowed the CIA to spy on our cell phones, to spy on our computers, to even operate our cars. Is that true?
Well, you know, I'm not for sure. I'm not like really a tech guy. You know, and that's a kind of another irony of this, is I've been so involved in this case for 8 years. And I'm really not like, I'm kind of a Luddite, to be honest with you. But, you know, Vault 7, if you take a look at some of the revelations, not what Julian just put out in WikiLeaks, but amplified by Stefano Morizzi, which I didn't really know about, that these, I didn't know that these things could existed, and how far reaching and how crazy innovative they were. Yes, they can do that. All the things, television sets, they say refrigerators. I don't know about that, but there's so many ways the CIA can spy on us, and they invented all of these different vehicles. They were outed on it, and so they have a long memory. They do not forget. I'm just surprised right now, as I think about it, on Vault 7, and the fact that he's out, that he's even out, because I didn't think he was going to get out. I thought he was going to die in prison. A lot of people I've been talking to the last couple of days really did not think he was going to get out, that this was something that was going to drag on. And maybe it would have. We don't know. I don't know what kind of deal, how it was set, what the fear was, the final moments to let this gentleman out, this brave journalist. But none of us thought he was going to live. We all thought that he was just going to die in prison, because that's what the CIA wanted. They wanted him to die in prison. And that doesn't mean that he's clear right now. You know, he may be in Australia. He may be in some secure place, but I don't know. Are we ever secure from the CIA?
No. Randy, Julian's supporters maintain that he was guilty of the so-called crime of journalism. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that's one of the slogans. Journalism is not a crime, and yes, he was practicing journalism, and they wrapped it under the 1917 Espionage Act, which was originally, and the only reason why it ever passed in 1917 was a vehicle to repress the anti-war movement. We know what it was all about. Everyone in the Senate back then knew what it was about, and the House of Representatives, it had nothing to do. They only had prosecuted 4 or 5 Germans out of the 2,000 that were prosecuted on a federal level in 1918. Even the movie producer, that guy, Goldstein, Robert Goldstein, but they never, it was used for any anti-war sentiment. You know, Eugene Debs, for instance. It's so archaic, and it's so unnecessary. This act is so antiquated. But to prosecute him under the Espionage Act of 1917, and for journalism, they're saying that he wasn't a journalist, but he is a journalist. He did practice journalism. He was a publisher. Maybe he'll go back to publishing. So that he's being charged. How can you charge someone who's a journalist when you're protected by the First Amendment? So they contorted this entire indictment just to immobilize a journalist and strike fear in other journalists who may wander into the same freedom of press road.
We all know that the CIA had a particular animus against Julian. As you mentioned, he disclosed the Vault 7 papers showing that we were being monitored. And the CIA has, for its own part, been exposed as trying to kidnap and murder Julian. How do you explain this?
Well, of course, back in 2017, I was there. I visited him three times in 2017, September and November twice. And that was the year, How do I know? Anybody want to find out? Well, you just go to the UC Global Archives and you'll see video of me being videotaped while I was there. I never made this a legal issue, but that was the year where Mike Pompeo drew up plans to assassinate Julian Assange. They were so upset. Remember, they were back in March or February, when that came out, 2017, Pompeo went wild, went crazy. And so they came up with these plans. First of all, they're spying on everyone. They come up with plans on kidnapping him, assassinating him. Yeah, the CIA, that's why everyone was fearful that if he came to this country, would he survive a trial? First of all, it would take 5 years for him with all the briefs and going back and forth. But if he were to survive, would he survive the 5 years in the process? And, you know, I talked to Seymour Hersh. He said he'd be dead within 5 days and by the CIA once he got over here. So, and I subscribe to that analysis. Yeah, it's a criminal organization. I mean, come on. Lumumba, they tried to kill Castro. They killed Che. They killed, how many people have they killed? They killed Torrijos and General Zia. I mean, they kill people. That's what they do. They assassinate. They do a lot of bad things. And you know, there's nothing, there's no oversight of the CIA, less now than ever. And so they're basically a state within a state, and they operate with impunity.
I can answer that question, Randy, because Michael Ratner and I did a book on who and why killed Che Guevara.
No, it's a great book, and I was gonna like mention that, but I didn't know the name of the book. I know the book that by you and Michael Ratner. It's a tremendous piece of work.
And in our research, we discovered that the CIA had attempted to or succeeded in killing 50 leaders of foreign countries. That's all documented in the book Killing Hope. But in any case, Randy Credico, let me ask you this. Julian had to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit espionage by receiving and publishing information which compromised the American government. Although a guilty plea is not precedent, do you think it was something that would scare journalists and prevent them from doing the kind of thing that Julian and his organization, WikiLeaks, did?
Oh, well, you know, Michael, I mean, it's a good question. And I've been talking to people for the last couple of days about this, about the fact that he pled guilty to it. I think he was tortured he's been tortured, physically, mentally tortured. I just spoke to Nils Melzer about this. And of course, he has problems with the fact that he pled guilty to this one charge out of the 17 or 18 charges that were on the indictment. But he said, under duress, will it hold up? Can he appeal it? I think there's a lot of problems with the fact that he signed this in the sense that he doesn't have any legal remedy, can't even make FOIA requests on the indictment at this point. He's forfeited a lot of research that could be done by his lawyers. But I'm not a lawyer. I think Heidi can answer that better than I can. But I know that this was elicited under duress and psychological and physical torture over the last 5 years and 3 months that he's been in Belmarsh. And before that, the 8 years that he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. Look, when people are tortured, they talk. I mean, go to Guantanamo. They talk. People who are disciplined, they talk when they're tortured. He was tortured, not in the same way, not waterboarded, but, you know, being in that cell day in and day out, that cell without his computer, without being able to practice journalism, without seeing his kids, without seeing his mother who's dying in Australia and being deprived, you know, fresh air. You know, treated like a gorilla in a zoo. Not even that well. He goes into court. He's behind it. He's there like Eichmann was in Israel back in 1961. The same in a glass cage, except for Eichmann had contact, was able to communicate with his lawyers in the courtroom. Julian Assange couldn't. You know, he had to put a piece of paper, you know, through the plexiglass to communicate with Stella and the Spanish lawyer, Garzon. So, I mean, look, the guy was tortured. Does this hold up in court? Maybe Heidi can answer that. She's a constitutional scholar.
Well, I wouldn't say scholar. Thank you for that, Randy. Julian was incapacitated mentally as well as physically. And I would think there would be a strong argument that he was under undue influence, didn't have the same mental capacity he would have 6 years ago to make an informed judgment on that. And also, we're looking at the reality that not signing it is basically ringing a death knell for Julian. You saw him. What was it like? What was his mental state and his physical condition when you visited him several times?
Well, the last time I saw him, you know, the guy was okay. He was agitated the first time I saw him, just the frustration. And it was very difficult. You've been to prison. You've seen Mumia. And when you walk out, it's painful because you get to go outside and he's got to stay. Well, that was in the embassy there. He knew that he was being spied on then. All right. He showed me the assassination posts across the street, platforms, you know, from the side where he was being spied on. The guy is really brilliant. And so, yeah. And then I spoke to him last time. It was 2018 when they shut him down by phone. And he says, you just make noise. And then what's his name? Cut him off. I think February 2018, Lyndon Moreno cut him off from the world. And so, you know, for the ensuing 8 months, 9 months, a year, actually a year until April of 2019 when he was kidnapped and renditioned. He was going through a lot of torture. And you know, Niels Melzer has visited him a couple of times. And they have documented that the guy is being physically, has been, irreparable damage. I just spoke to Niels this morning, as I said, irreparable damage. And I don't know, how does one react when they can't come close to seeing their kids? You know what I mean? It's like, reminds me of Lucy Parsons, Parsons from Haymarket. She used to visit her husband but couldn't bring the kids in. This is the same thing 120 years later, that he could not see his kids inside that prison there for 5 years. They don't even know their father. You know, they have no communication with their father. How much can you possibly take? I know I couldn't take it. I know, you know, maybe you have to be a Marine to be able to undergo that kind of torture. You got to have the training. I have no idea.
Well, Randy Credico, let me ask you this. I believe, and I ask your opinion, that it was the worldwide support for Julian that finally got him out of there. What's your opinion of that?
Absolutely. You know, look, when I first, you know, back in 2017, when I first did this show, I got so much pushback, even at WBAI, among some of the producers there. You know, this is right after the election. Remember, right after the election, everyone, even some people that you know and I know very well, were going after Julian and you know, connecting him to Roger Stone and to Trump and all of that. It was complete nonsense. And then the sex charges, all of these things, these allegations, never charges, allegations that were completely fabricated. They were debunked by Niels Melzer thoroughly, but the CIA and the Defense Department were a part of this. They did everything they could to destroy his reputation and totally vilify the man and totally demean his character and destroy his character. But over the years, when people started understanding and started getting involved and listening and knowing what our government does, it led to an international movement. And I was happy to be part of that. It was really strong in London, weaker in the U.S., but it did pick up. But in his home country of Australia, all of that stuff was responsible for him getting out. Without a street movement, if this was, you know, if it didn't have the kind of backing that it did from the public, which took a long time. It wasn't like overnight. It took a long time for it to percolate to the point where it started putting pressure on the Australian government and the British government. Not so much here, but, you know, I think they felt it and people were getting involved. And without a a vibrant street movement, without getting the asses of the masses out there, there is no change. So it's, yes, there were a lot of radio shows and a lot of my show, and there are other shows and podcasts and all of that, but they pale in comparison to the impact that a vibrant street movement and organizing does to move a cause forward. And that definitely played, and everyone has admitted that the street movement and the voices that have popped up around the world definitely was the key in the success of him, in spite of what we think about implications of him signing this plea agreement. In spite of that, the fact that he got out, no one ever thought that he'd be alive, he'd live through this. The fact that he got out, it's only because of what you just pointed out, the street movement, not just the street movement, but the worldwide movement.
Well said.
Tell us about
the fabulous van that you organized in D.C.
Yes. First of all, I just castigated my friend for going on television and calling it a van, and that is Afshin Ratanzi. And Roger Waters says, Credico's van. It wasn't a van. Now, you know what a van looks like. A van is a VW van. This was not a van. This was a huge, there were three of them. First of all, it started out in D.C., and we're talking about 15 feet by 10 feet, okay? 15 by 10 feet. These were giant. The first one was a U-Haul truck converted into a regular billboard. And so it was huge, all right? And then there was a second one that was the size of a regular pickup truck in D.C. And then there was, in New York City, I had two that were 20 by 17, okay? 22 by 17. Two of them. And then I had two digital trucks that were 15 by 7, 12. So they were not vans. They were big, and the digital trucks were great because we got to put out 30 images and have sound. We'd be able to go over to places like, let's say, St. Patrick's Cathedral, or by the skating rink at Rockefeller Center, and we'd play Collateral Murder, right, with the sound. And people got to see it for the first time because, let's be honest, they're not playing that stuff on mainstream media, and the average person is not listening to our podcasts and our radio shows. The average person that, you know, you go to D.C., you go to Alexandria, Virginia, they're totally oblivious to the elements of the Assange story and the evil prosecution and persecution. But what this what is not a van, it was, you may as well call it a tricycle. This thing was, they were all huge, and we were all over this. Look, I'll tell you, I really enjoy it because I like being on the street. I'm one of those who loves the action more than I like being in a studio. I'd rather be on the street involved. It's like Battle of Hastings, you know, King Harold and King William. They were both on the battlefield. I'd rather be on the battlefield than sitting on with my crown on my head in the palace. So I like it. I like being on the streets. But the problem is I ruined my legs. I mean, we're talking about 5 foot, 6 foot drop from the seat down to the ground. And, you know, it's not like being in a Corvair where you just put your foot and you're on the ground. This was like a long drop, and I was jumping out like I'm a parachuter and I'm 18 years old in the military and coming out. And by the end of the 2-year run, I spent 200 days out there in the, we call it the DC Assange mobile billboard, Free Assange mobile billboard. And then we had the NYC Free Assange mobile billboard, digital and regular. So there were three trucks running at one time in New York City. Costs a lot of money. We were able to get through it and spent all the money where I had it going up here and down in D.C. at the same time that the hearings were going on what was called X Day. If you remember that, February 21st and 22nd. So because I figured we had, and we stood the mobile billboards and the regular billboards would stand for hours in front of the UK consulate on 2nd Avenue in DC at the UK consulate, and actually their mission there in downtown DC. And they would go in front of the UN and park in front of the UN, two big trucks, and then the mobile truck. And we'd go around and round and round and round. And you know, you go to these places like in front of MSNBC, CNN, and the response was very good. Response is good, and you get out, you give people information, you get signatures, and you drive around and drive around 8-10 hours a day. And so since, and I think now maybe MSNBC is doing stories on Assange, but they haven't for the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years. They, you know, it's like when something happens and they come out and give you a news flash. But unless you take it to the people, in this case, the people don't know about it. Now, I'll tell you another thing that I did, which is my proudest moment. And the reason why I don't go back to London was during the first trial. And I talked about the glass cage that Eichmann, similar to Eichmann, that I went to that trial and for the first phase of it. And I took pictures of it clandestinely. And, you know, and it's against the law to do that. It's a contempt of court. And they said they'd jail anybody. And so I smuggled those pictures out. I'll never go back to London again. And you can see clearly that for the last photo of Julian Assange until you saw him the other day that was public was this picture of him sitting there in such a bad mental state. You can see it there in the photos that I had, the despair, the lack of life spiritually that he was undergoing. And that was the very first phase of the four-year, five-year show trial odyssey. Back in February of 2020. So, and I think these things like that, you got to be proactive. And the truck thing was really a labor of love. I'm glad that it's over. I won't ever have to do that again. But I, as you know, I said the other day, I put my first post up on Twitter in a while. I said, okay, this one's over. And I said, next. And the next had a picture of Leonard Peltier and Mumia.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, they need that kind of movement right now. And that's the thing is that, that Assange has drained us, and these two guys.
Okay.
You're going to take a break, and then you're going to get back out into the streets. Your billboards had a huge effect, and it's a genius project that we need to emulate all around the country. But we are out of time. Michael and I both thank you for your steadfast work in defending Julian and getting his message out, and for all the other organizing you've done over the decades.
Well, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
International Criminal Court, which was set up in 1998, and the International Court of Justice, which was set up much earlier, were installed to help prevent wars and crimes against humanity, with the profound understanding that without a system of international law, a future World War III might eliminate humanity. The United States of America, under Bill Clinton, was one of the 7 countries that voted against the Rome Statute, which set up the International Criminal Court. Clinton did eventually sign the statute, but George Bush unsigned it, and the United States of America has had a testy relationship with that court. Indeed, under Trump, the U.S. imposed sanctions on the court and its prosecutor. Last month, Imran Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, asked for the arrest on warrants for war crimes and crimes against humanity for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the Israeli Minister of Defense, as well as three other top leaders of Hamas. We speak today with attorney Reed Brody. He was a friend, colleague, and mentee of our late co-host Michael Ratner. Reed Brody is the author of the recently published book, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré. He has worked for many years with Human Rights Watch. Reed Brody has helped pursue the dictatorships of Augusto Pinochet in Chile and Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier in Haiti. He has uncovered atrocities by U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua, led United Nations missions in El Salvador and the Congo, and exposed Bush administration torture. Reed Brody, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Very glad to be here, Michael and Heidi.
Reed, out of the 54 individuals indicted by the ICC since its inception, 47 are Africans. How has this been appreciated by the courts, civil society, intellectuals, and yourself, considering that the ICC turned into a platform, many are alleging, whose former colonial masters cast too great an influence on non-European countries? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it's clearly true that the court has basically only prosecuted Africans. I think there are two reasons for that. One is benign and one is less benign. In general, the court, which was created in 1998, only has jurisdiction in, absent a referral by the UN Security Council, the court only has jurisdiction over crimes that are committed either by the nationals of countries who have ratified the Rome Statute that was adopted in 1998, or on the territory of countries that have accepted the court's jurisdiction. So if a Syrian commits crimes against humanity against other Syrians in Syria, and Syria is not a party to the court statute, then only with the Security Council can a case come before the court. And it happens that the greatest block of countries that both supported the idea of the court and are now parties to the court are African countries. And there's a geographical overlap in Africa between countries that had ratified the court's treaty and countries where atrocities have been committed. So the court is a court of limited jurisdiction. And many of the cases in Africa were actually brought by, were referred to the court by the countries themselves, by Congo, Democratic Republic, by Mali, by the Central African Republic, etc. But then you have the Security Council. The Security Council referred cases to the ICC relating to Libya and to Sudan, for instance. But there are vetoes, obviously, at the Security Council, so that it doesn't touch countries protected by the members of the Security Council. In addition, and I think we'll be talking a lot about Palestine, that's where the double standards have come in particular, the prosecutors not looking at crimes committed by the U.S. and U.S. allies, and we can get into that. But it's a court of limited jurisdiction, and the United States has always had a very testy relationship, let's say, with the court.
Reed, I understand that the ICC is an outgrowth of the horrors of World War II. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So in the aftermath of World War II, it was decided by the victorious powers, after a lot of discussion, to organize the prosecution of Nazi war criminals, essentially. And the famous Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II, which was a court set up by Russia, by the Soviet Union, the United States, Great Britain, and France, as the victorious powers, tried a number of German war criminals. A similar tribunal was held in the Far East, in Tokyo, of Japanese war criminals. And from Nuremberg in particular came the idea of that the norm would be that war crimes would be punished never again. Of course, even at the time, Nuremberg and even to a greater extent Tokyo were seen as victor's justice. The carpet bombing of or the destruction of German cities was not before the court. The use of atomic weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not before the court. But the idea was created and go forward that there should be a permanent international court to prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, whenever they occurred. The problem is that in the paralysis of the Cold War, it was impossible to move forward with that. And it was only when the geopolitical situation changed, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the atrocities in the former Yugoslavia resulted in a tribunal, the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and then a similar tribunal after the genocide in Rwanda, for Rwanda. And that really put back on the table the idea of a permanent international criminal court. And in 1998, I was in Rome at the diplomatic conference in July 1998, when the countries of the world essentially negotiated the statute of the ICC. As I said before, leading that charge were democratic countries in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe. The United States wanted an international criminal court. It just didn't want a court that could potentially prosecute Americans or to some extent, or to lesser extent, Israelis. And the United States pushed first to have the Security Council have the veto over the ICC's docket. And when that failed, they argued that the court should only have jurisdiction over nationals of countries who have ratified the statute. In the end, as I said, the court was also given jurisdiction over crimes committed in territories and states that have ratified the statute, so that if an American, say, commits a crime in Afghanistan, which is a state party, the court has jurisdiction. And that's what the United States could not accept. The United States was one of the seven countries that voted against the statute of the ICC. That's kind of the line between Nuremberg and the modern Nuremberg, which is the permanent international criminal court.
Reed, Palestinians have tried for the past 15 years to enlist the ICC's help in holding Israel accountable. Please talk about that.
So I think that's really a key issue today. I mean, three successive prosecutors of the ICC have given the Palestinians the slow walk. So the Palestinian Authority invoked the jurisdiction of the ICC. The first prosecutor basically spent several years mulling over the question of whether the Palestinian Authority had that right under the ICC statute as a state before punting it to the General Assembly. At a certain point, the General Assembly then proved Palestine as a non-member observer state, and the case went back to the ICC. The next prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, spent several years looking at the case before finally, just as she was about to leave, 5 years later, opened up a formal investigation of potential Israeli war crimes. These are crimes that go back, according to the jurisdiction of the court, to the CAST-led operation in Gaza, but also include things like settlements which are war crimes to move your population into occupied territories. It also includes collective punishment and things like that. But basically, even, and then this prosecutor, Kareem Khan, who was elected, I believe, now 3 years ago, probably the most politically savvy of the three prosecutors, he clearly was not moving forward with this investigation until October 7th and the aftermath of October 7th. But essentially, Palestine was exhibit A for the idea that this court was engaged in double standards. When Russia invaded Ukraine, followed by mass atrocities in Ukraine, the prosecutor, as he should, was very prompt in going to Ukraine. A number of Western states gave extra budgetary resources to the ICC to investigate in the Ukraine, opened up their own investigations, sent experts to help with the investigations, and within a year, Vladimir Putin had been indicted for the illegal transfer, for the alleged illegal transfer of children. All this time, nothing was going on in the Palestinian investigation.
Reid Brody, the ICC chief prosecutor, Kareem Khan, said last month that, quote, "I have reasonable grounds to believe that Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant are criminally responsible for war, war crimes, and crimes against humanity," end quote. What has been the reaction of the governments of the United States and Israel to that assertion?
So the prosecutor made that assertion while he was requesting arrest warrants for Netanyahu, Gallant, and three Hamas leaders. And this was really a watershed moment in international justice. I mean, it was the first time that the ICC prosecutor had requested warrants against a Western ally like Israel. In fact, it's the first time since Nuremberg that the instruments of international justice have been used to look at crimes, committed by a Western ally. I mean, up until now, it had always been defeated adversaries like Tokyo and Nuremberg, powerless African rebels, or enemies of the West, like Putin and Slobodan Milosevic. This is the first time that really the international justice is being used to hold accountable such a strong U.S. ally. So Israel and the United States reacted very, very strongly. Israel obviously had advance warning that this was going to happen. They had, in fact, announced several weeks earlier that they thought warrants were coming down. We now know that Israel had hacked into the prosecutor's office. And so they were prepared to try to castigate this. I mean, Israel talked about the prosecutors being anti-Semitic. United States officials, the Biden administration, said it was outrageous. Republican senators started threatening the ICC prosecutor. So there's been a very, very strong reaction in the United States.
Reid, do you see Palestine as the litmus test of the international order?
Well, that's a big question. I certainly think it's where, the rule of law is being tested. And I think, interestingly, I mean, we've seen not just at the International Criminal Court, which has requested warrants, but in the sister court in The Hague, the International Court of Justice, which is the world court, the highest UN court that resolved disputes among states. We saw the case being brought by South Africa, accusing Israel of genocide. And so the two most really important cases moving forward now relating to international law, to international criminal law, to the international order, are cases involving Israel and Palestine. And it's very early to say how this is going to shake out, but those countries that believe in international law to defend Ukraine, they have to be believing in international law also when it comes to defending Palestinian rights. And I think that we're seeing for the first time these two institutions, the International Criminal Court on the one hand, the International Court of Justice on the other hand, being used by poor countries, by countries that have typically been on the business end of, you know, international aggression and relations.
Reed, what has Israel done to derail the ICC inquiries into Israeli war crimes?
So, I mean, we have now learned from reports in The Guardian and in Israeli online publications that over the last decade, Israelis have conducted a vast undercover operation to hack in to the prosecutor's office, to try a sting operation using the former, this mostly happened under the former prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. We found out that they had lured her into rooms where she was being taped, that they also brought in the former president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Joseph Kabila, who apparently surreptitiously taped conversations with the prosecutor, all in an attempt to blackmail her. I mean, the fact that the Israeli government announced a month in advance that these warrants were likely to come down shows that the surveillance continued. We also learned from Israeli publications, Benjamin Netanyahu is even talking about dates for the warrant to be issued. So it would suggest that Israel still has intelligence about what's going on in the court. Now, these are very serious allegations, and we understand that the Dutch, which of course are the host country, have demanded explanations from Israel why the director of Mossad personally was allegedly involved in these incidents. I mean, it just shows the kind of contempt the government of Israel has towards the court, and in fact could be, as the prosecutor has himself said, these are things that could be charged as obstruction of justice.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Haida Boghossian, and we're speaking here on Law and Disorder with international lawyer Reed Brody. Reed, the former head of the Mossad, personally harassed and threatened Khan's predecessor, warning her, quote, "You don't want to be getting into things that could compromise your security or that of your family." Despite this, Khan requested the arrest warrants. How do you appreciate that?
Yeah, I think it's quite amazing that these warrants were issued. Even after October 7th and the attacks by Hamas and the response by Israel, I saw the prosecutor in last December at the assembly of the International Criminal Court in New York. Many of us came away with the feeling that he didn't want to cross this red line, that he understood, not because maybe because of these threats, but just that in the way the world works, that the U.S. had drawn a red line and that no prosecutor was going to, go after Israeli officials. Even when the prosecutors in the past, when Fatou Bensouda in the past had began the investigation in Israel, had an investigation open to U.S. crimes alleged in Afghanistan, the U.S. had, under the Trump administration, had sanctioned the prosecutor, the prosecutor's family, and the court. This prosecutor, very politically savvy, I don't think that this is where he wanted to go, but I frankly think that the relentless Israeli onslaught, the disproportion, the collective punishment of the Palestinian people, the general consensus in the world that these the criminality of Israeli actions, the case before the other court in The Hague, the genocide case brought by South Africa, all of these things ultimately made it untenable, I think, for the prosecutor not to act. And I think the prosecutor understood this was something that ultimately, if the ICC was going to be a respected institution, if he was going to be a respected prosecutor, they were going to follow the facts and the law. This was something he just could not ignore Israeli conduct.
Reed, do you think the pendulum is shifting? Is Gaza changing the world?
You know, to me, I think the double standards that were exposed by Israeli behavior in Gaza are changing perceptions of international law. They're changing perceptions of what the rules-based international order means. I've been working with people who are trying to set up mechanisms on Russian crimes in Ukraine. And throughout the global South, there's this feeling that unless you do something about Israeli actions in Gaza and in the occupied territory, Palestinian territory in general, this rules-based international order doesn't mean anything. And so I think we are seeing a shift in attitudes. Many European countries that are allies of Israel, countries that didn't necessarily agree with the actions by the ICC prosecutor have said, look, if this warrant is issued, we will have to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. He comes under. We are ICC state parties. Nobody is above the law. And so my hope is that this will lead to a rejuvenation of the idea of international law, international criminal law, and accountability.
Reed Brody, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time. But before Heidi and I have to let you go, let me ask you this. How can people follow your work?
So I'm now an independent human rights prosecutor, I guess. So I don't have directly a website. I would suggest that people look at the articles that I have written in The Nation magazine on international justice. I've written about 7 or 8 over the last year. But also the websites of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Dawn. I'm on the board of Democracy for the Arab World Now, Dawn, D-A-W-N, which is a wonderful organization. And people can follow our work there on the Dawn website.
Thank you very much. You take it easy.
Bye-bye. Take care. See you soon.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I was dreaming in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry. Come on.
Hold on.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. where there were deserts. I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled there together, when under laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice.
Here I am in New York City. Yes, I am walking down Broadway. Oh, look at the girl. I'll stroll into the turntable, then have a bite at Tommy Smalls. Bright lights, big city, I think I'm gonna have myself a ball. New York City, oh, 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 big boss town, you're so nice. Everybody, got so much respect for ya. They named you twice. See the hustlers and the bus.